Okay, so we're pleased to have Pegasystems here today. And joining us from the company is Ken Stillwell. He joined in 2016. He's been the CFO since then. And more recently, he's become the COO. On Pegasystems itself, we rate them as narrow moat with a stable trend. We have a 157 fair value estimate. So we see a little upside from here. So Ken, thanks for joining us. Welcome. Can you please give us a quick overview of Pegasystems for investors who are listening in who maybe aren't so familiar with the name?
Sure. Thanks, Dan, and good to be with you today. So Pegasystems is we sell solutions in I would say primarily two segments of the market. One is the CRM segment, customer relationship management segment, and in that space, I would say we're kind of tipped toward customer service and marketing. And in the digital process automation, some people kind of connect that to what was previously called business process management. But those are our two kind of primary, solution areas. When we think about digital process automation, it involves things like robotics, low code, process workflow management, helping to orchestrate work, whether that be front or back office across the organization. Typically, things that have maybe multiple steps in the process and are being done at scale. So it could be things like a dispute or an inquiry on a credit card. It could be a loan origination or a credit card origination. Things that have scale processes, you're trying to automate it, you're typically touching a lot of systems. On the CRM side, there's some similarities where you're thinking about doing something in real time, potentially using data from multiple data sources, like in our one-to-one customer engagement solution, where you are leveraging a decision model and certain data that you gain as you're operating the system to self-learn and to kind of curate better decisions, and then to automate those AI-driven decisions in the digital channel with the customer. So things that are very similar, workflow across integration with multiple systems, lots of automation using robotics, AI-driven next best offer, next best decision. So those are the things that are similar across both.
Great, thanks. That is very helpful. the second quarter you reported in July, really an excellent quarter. Maybe you just want to touch on some of the highlights there as you saw it, just so again, so everyone can sort of be on the same page.
Sure. I think Q2 was a really interesting quarter on a number of fronts. One, it was the largest sequential ACV add that we've ever had in a non-Q4. Naturally, Q4s are always strong for enterprise software because of the buying cycles and how kind of over time they deals can tend to get compressed at the ends of calendar or budget years for both the seller, Pega, and the buyer, our clients. But other than a Q4, this has been the strongest quarter we've ever had. The sequential growth in ACV, the ACV growth from in Q2 was something like 75% greater than the Q2 of 2020. So it was really, and we built backlog at the same time. We had our, I think revenue in Q2 was our highest revenue, maybe of the company's history, certainly highest of a Q2. Our growth is significant in revenue. You're seeing us come out of the transition. So lots of goodness across the business in terms of increasing our penetration with our clients, showing that we have lots of upsell capability with even our largest clients. We disclosed a very large increase of a customer relationship with a long-standing client. And also seeing some re-acceleration of our ACV over ACV growth over Q1. So I think Q2 was really a kind of a knockout quarter on all fronts.
Yeah, it certainly was. And there's some things I want to follow up in there in your response. But first, I guess one more big picture thing, so we can all benefit from this as well. You mentioned right away that you play in CRM and sort of the automation areas. You want to maybe provide an op, you know, like how large the opportunity is for Pegasystems and like how fast those markets are growing.
Sure. So the markets that we're in, if you aggregate all of the TAM on an annual basis for the markets that we're in, it's well over $100 billion, probably approaching $150 billion over the next few years per year. Now, we only feel like we address about half of that. So we estimate our kind of opportunity just kind of somewhere in the $60 to $80 billion range, depending on I would even say splitting hairs on whether it's 60 or 100 or 80 is kind of not as important as just say it's extremely large over the size of the business. And those markets in aggregate are growing somewhere on the low end, maybe 11 or 12%, on the high end, maybe closer to 15%. So they're growing at a healthy clip as a market. And we've been outpacing that market growth certainly for the last 5 years or so in terms of our growth rate. So that's kind of how I would think about it. It's a huge market. It's growing to well over $100 billion market for us over in the coming years. But that total market, like if you really look at the markets we're in, it's probably, probably approaching $200 billion market when you get out to 2025. So we're just, we're trying to be honest about, we can't address all of that market, but we can certainly address approximately half of it. And the reason why, let me clarify why, because we're not in every vertical and we don't sell to every single organization. So if you just if you focus on our verticals and you focus on kind of the global 2,000 or 3,000 in those verticals, that's about, our estimate is about half of the demand.
Got it. And I guess as a follow-up to that one real quick, do you see Pegasystems perhaps moving into other verticals? I know this started mainly as like a financial services sort of case management product way back when. So maybe talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so we started in financial services. The verticals that we're in have a heavy reliance, dependence, connection to end consumers. So if you think about telecommunications or insurance or healthcare, or consumer manufacturing, even public sector, which has constituents on the back end. So I definitely think there are other verticals that have a similar trend of having the consumers kind of on the end point. Now, whether we go to market directly in those verticals or we go to market with our partners in those verticals, like in an ISV model or even with our partners as being the seller, I think that's to be determined. But I would predict that we will expand into new verticals because the use cases, if you think about an exception or an incident management, those happen across all the verticals. We just happened to pick the ones where we knew the use cases and we felt like that was the lowest hanging fruit, but there's lots of other verticals that we could enter. Just a question of whether we go direct or through partners.
Got it, makes sense. And you first have to go with the lowest hanging fruit. So I think strategically, I think we'd all be in the same shoes there. One thing that I just wonder about, because I hear it from every company basically that I cover, and as I talk to customers and stuff, I read it in pretty much every news article I see, and everyone's saying digital transformation. That's kind of one of those things where everyone, sort of nods their head and says, yeah, digital transformation, totally. But really, can you help us get our arms around like what that means and like, what this really means for Pegasystems, over the next 5 years or the next 2 years?
Sure. We actually have I'll use an example, anonymized, but a client had a client conversation last week, and what they're trying to do really, I think, kind of just really makes digital transformation very real in the use case. They're a consumer retail products company, and very large, and they have supply chain. They have customer demand. They sell in multiple countries. So they have to think about how do we do the logistics on products, on offering? How do we make sure that we're putting things to the right customer locations? How do we deal with the digital stores and how we sell? And so you can imagine that they have ERP systems that are different. They have user interfaces that are different by country. They have different marketing solutions in some of the business units. So things are very fragmented across the organization. They want Pega, and they're using Pega now, but they're looking to expand the relationship where we at Pega will help to create a digital fabric, a process fabric, a workflow fabric across all of those disparate applications to assist in automating, speeding up, using AI to drive scalability and speed and hopefully to take the number of humans required to actually manage the transactions and the systems lower than what they have now. So what that solution is doing is that's digital transformation, connecting disparate systems in an automated way, real time, trying to reduce the human effort that is needed to process transactions, to deal with exceptions, to communicate and support with their clients. Now, here's the interesting thing. A few years ago, digital transformation or the like would have been thought to be connected with, well, I want to reduce costs. I want to get rid of people in the company. If I can implement some software, maybe I can cut half of my staff. The discussion now is very different. It's actually not about the cost as much as it is about where will I find the people that I need to hire to be able to scale these organizations. The resource pool is now somewhat disrupted because of everything that's happened over the last few years. And they're worried that they'll be able to even hire the people that they would need to build the processes and manage the process for a scaling company. So they need digital transformation just because they don't actually have the resources and don't believe they can hire even the processing center resources or human beings around the globe. So it's just an interesting how the problem has changed from, I want to try to save some costs by getting rid of a few heads, to I can't actually scale my business if I don't do digital transformation because there aren't enough people out there that will come into our facilities and actually execute the work. So I think it's become a more of a cost savings driver to like a must have because you can't scale your business if you don't have it.
Thanks for that. That's actually very insightful. I'm trying to furiously write some stuff down too, because there's a lot of insight in there that you don't normally get from, you know, like an earnings call or a follow up or like a Wall Street Journal article. So that's great. Thanks. Maybe also let's outline the financial targets. I know you have a slide in your own Investor Day deck. It's kind of like 15 to 17% revenue growth, 23 to 25% operating margins. I think that is like for the next few years, but obviously there's a model transition going on here. So can you talk about, you know, like how these evolve, you know, over the next few years and perhaps beyond that a little bit?
Sure. It's probably good, Dan, to give a little context of where we were and where we are on this journey to cloud, because things have changed a little bit over the last 5 years, which is, you know, they haven't changed a ton, but they've changed enough that it's probably worthwhile to clarify. When we started this journey, we thought about moving to recurring. SaaS was not necessarily a big part of the movement at the beginning. It was move to recurring, drive revenue growth of 15%, maybe with some upside, and get EBITDA or free cash flow margins to 25. That's bad. If I go all the way back to 2016, 2017, that's the first, when I first started Pega, that was my first kind of long-term target, so to speak. Well, some things have changed. One, our growth rate has accelerated as we've moved to subscription. Our growth rate is no longer 15%, it's more like 20. And we would hope that we can even get it closer to 25 in the coming years. The second thing that changed was more of our business is SaaS now, Pega Cloud. Pega Cloud was only growing at 25 or 30% when I started. Now it's growing at, you know, mid to high 40% at reasonable scale. So you have a very different business in Pega Cloud. That's the second thing that changed. The next thing that changed was our commitment to try to accelerate this growth opportunity. And so we have been increasing the investment over the last few years in our go-to-market resources to try to build more capacity to help fuel that future growth. So with that, we kind of have a different perspective now in the Investor Day that we did in early 2021 versus the Investor Day that we did in 2017, where we now see the business as the growth rate being kind of closer to the low 20% range. You know, we talked about 21 to 23% in 2023, with maybe even some upside from there, and our free cash flow margin being kind of more kind of at the 15% range. So what's happened is we went from a business that was going to grow 15% and have 25% operating margins, just using high level numbers, to hopefully a business that could grow 25% and have 15% operating margins using kind of high level numbers. The much more valuable business, much more exciting business to increase the growth rate. And we're still kind of close to that rule of 40 concept that I've been helping to ma- you know helping us manage the business to be accountable to that, you know, kind of trade-off between growth and profitability.
Yeah, so I'll follow up on that one because I love the rule of 40. I have a couple of slides on it in my own marketing deck, and I sort of rank all of those companies under my coverage. And it's, so that slide gets actually a lot of investor interest, so we talk about it a lot. So maybe, and I think there's like little definitional differences you can have. So maybe, you know, why is rule of 40 something that you focus on? And like, what exactly is like your definition of, you know, like the margin part of this?
So yeah, it's a great question. So rule of 40 is not something that I invented, but certainly something that I embraced from my very first day at Pega. And it really comes from my private equity background. Without naming companies, I've worked for a number of private equity firms, and I really learned a lot about how value is created through through acceleration of growth, but smart growth, and making sure that you're really connecting, you know, a well-balanced scorecard to the outcomes that you're trying to get. Now, I think private equity does a much better job than, quite frankly, the public markets do around that. But I would also say that there's also a skew towards profitability typically in private equity. So I learned a lot about just managing that balance of that. So I have to give some credit to my experiences prior to Pega. When I came to Pega, my view was very simple, which is, a company growing at a certain percentage rate should, as a responsible company, produce some consistent return. And there is an inverse relationship between the profitability and the growth rate of the business. I use ARR, ACV for the growth that is most relevant, because that's really the forward indicator around the productivity of the business. And I like to use non-GAAP or free cash flow margin, where software doesn't have a lot of capital expenditures. So EBITDA or free cash flow should converge to each other. They might be, you know, typically, I mean, we might have a percent or two of CapEx in a year, right? So there's not a tremendous gap there. So I've just always been focused on, you know, if you're going to grow faster, you can make less money in the short term because you're trying to get to scale. When you start to slow your growth, the cash flows need to increase to offset your reduced forward spending that you're doing. And so, so it's kind of a little bit of a religion for me, so to speak, in terms of how I think about the rule of 40. Now, here's the trick though. You can't always get caught up in just the optics of the number and calculation, because one, growth is certainly worth more than profitability in today's markets, and always is worth more. But the problem is you can't get to diminishing returns where you're spending too much to get that extra percentage of growth. The second thing is, when you're going through a cloud or a subscription transition, it's a really messy reporting exercise that you go through because it's GAAP. So you can't get caught up in that, because you will not see the forest for the trees, so to speak, in terms of seeing what's really happening. So you need a way to adjust back to that. Now, ACV and ARR, the beauty of that is that regardless of the accounting, ACV or ARR is actually a very credible metric, no matter what the GAAP accounting. And backlog is another metric that kind of confirms that you're actually continuing to get the duration. Duration ties to retention, right? The reason why you want multi-year contracts is because you keep the retention high, because clients don't get an every day, every month, every year even opportunity to change their mind, right? They make a commitment, and they typically, when people make long-term commitments, they tend to be more kind of embedded with you as a partner, as opposed to someone that's buying each month where they don't necessarily have that same relationship. Then the last point I would make on this is that when you make significant investments in the business, there's a gestation period for actually seeing that growth kick in. In enterprise software, that takes a little bit more time, right? Because you don't hire a salesperson and they're productive 90 days later. You typically hire a salesperson, it might take a year or 2 years for companies like Salesforce, ServiceNow, Pega, others like us, to be able to get to that productivity curve that you want. So you have to be really careful to be measuring your productivity, measuring the ramp, and thinking about the investments I make today are probably going to pay off in 2023. They're not going to pay off in 21. They may not even pay off fully in 22. So sometimes the rule of 40 can be, it's a great tool, but you have to look through it a little bit and make sure that you're thinking about the business, kind of stepping back, so that you're not getting kind of overly math focused on the calculation and you miss the forest for the trees, so to speak.
Excellent, excellent points. And so that's why I wanted to know about the definitions, because I don't really define it in exactly the same way. It's hard to get all software companies sort of providing the same metrics. So, sort of do what we have to. But then when you show them against one another, like all the differences sort of shake out, and it just makes for an interesting discussion. So I really appreciate that. So you talked a lot about Pegasystems model transition so far. So I guess two things, since I'm wondering like how far along we are in that. And then just sort of relatedly, you said like duration matters because you want retention high. Has retention changed at all as you've gone, or has the duration and retention, have those two elements changed at all as we've gone through this model transition?
So, with respect to the, I'll hit the duration one first, then I'll talk about the model transition. So, the duration, when Pega used to sell agreements, we either sold perpetual. If we didn't sell perpetual, there was a inherent benefit or motivation for the sales team to try to sell a 5-year contract. So what would happen is, and that was a little bit of the way our comp structure, the compensation structure was built, where if you sold a perpetual deal, you really had to sell a 5-year term deal to be able to get the same economics as you could get for a perpetual deal. So inevitably what would happen is people would sell a 5-year deal and they would discount the ACV because they got paid on total contract value. So there was almost a perverse incentive to reduce the ACV to get extra years committed. Now, that's not illogical for some companies, but with a company that has, a 98, 99% retention rate, you don't want to give up ACV to get an extra year or an extra 2 years, because the likelihood that the client is going to renew anyway, and to be honest with you, buy more, is very high. So we ended up, when we changed our comp plan, we made 3 years the model. So we really wanted duration to kind of hover or stay close to 3 years, because that seemed to be what the market was doing. That wasn't a number we made up. It was more what we saw the market selling. 3-year deals was a very common kind of approach. And I actually think kind of still is for many of our competitors. So that was kind of the duration. When you think about the movement, excuse me, the transition into the subscription model, there are three pieces that I've talked about, Dan. The first piece is the change in the go-to-market, the process of moving, the transitioning your sales team from going from selling perpetual to selling SaaS slash recurring. I would say we're done with that, right? We're I guess what, 4 years into that now? Yeah, 4 years into that, a little, maybe even a little over 4 years. So I think we've done an amazingly good job of flipping our sales teams to sell recurring. So I would call that done. Even though we have a couple percentage points of perpetual deals, those are very corner cases and oddball examples of clients that had perpetual rights. So let's call that one done. The next one is the revenue normalization phase. That typically doesn't end until you're through the 5-year transition. So we will still have some revenue normalization on growth rate this year and next year in 22, because 22 would be the 5th year of the transition. But I would say we're largely through that. You're already seeing that in our growth rate in 2021 for the first 6 months, and even the growth rate of what we guided, which was kind of more in line with our subscription growth rate. So I would call that like largely done. Maybe we'll call that 75% done. And then the last one is the cash flow normalization. Now, that doesn't normalize until you get a full year or two after the transition. So that would be more like 2023. Right, in 2023 is when the free cash flow margin starts to look like it should, like the business is out of the transition and on to normal operating cadence and normal and kind of more normal reporting. So the cash flow margin, I would kind of say we're maybe halfway through that, maybe even like slightly less than halfway through that, because you really have to get to the point where you want, remember the perpetual model, you were billing all the perpetual upfront. You went from doing that to billing none of it upfront and billing it over time as you stack in these recurring arrangements. So once you get to the 5th year, you kind of have normalized or caught up with where you would have been, like if you never changed your billing model. So that's kind of where you have to get to that point, and then your free cash flow starts to look more normal. So I would say look at us. Maybe if you averaged all three of those, we're maybe 60% of the way through the transition, the entire transition.
Okay, that is very helpful. These model transitions have been, you know, they're really interesting to try and model through. So I guess I have a quick follow-up on that, and that is, are we going to see like the customer base sort of ultimately forced into the SaaS model? That's just the follow-up. And then the next part of it is, just because these can be kind of messy at times and hard to follow, I know on the calls you talk about like ACV and RPO and ARR and just some of the things you've mentioned here. Could you like walk our investors through like what are the key metrics to focus on here?
The key metrics is always an interesting one because I have some in my mind that I think everybody should care about, right? So for example, key metric. Growth in recurring commitments from clients. Call that ARR, call that ACV, make up whatever number you want. To me, that's a critical measure, right? That's one. What's the net expansion rate or the net of cancellations, terminations of commitments? What's that net growth that you do with your existing clients versus how much do you get from net new logos? We've started to process some of that internally and categorize that. And I've even started to talk kind of directionally around some of that. And we'll start reporting that in the future where we can kind of get a view of what's happening with our clients and how are we upselling and cross-selling those existing clients versus getting ACV growth from net new logos. So that's another important measure. RPO, I think, is a measure of duration. And so if it's really RPO is not much more than duration, but there is one additional thing you can get with RPO is that you can get almost a forward prediction of revenue with some level of certainty because the way we disclose RPO, which I think is the most fulsome disclosure that I've seen in a public company, which is by each 12-month bucket, by each of the revenue streams, you can actually look in a year and you can say, at the end of Q3, how much did I think Pega Cloud should be this year versus last year based on a certain growth rate? And that should be relatively consistent kind of across the period. So it almost gives you a forward look, some level of a validation of how much revenue might be coming in the next 12 months. And then there's other metrics that I think are important, like cost of sales and marketing to compared to the growth, the net change in ACV. I think that's an important measure of sales productivity. There's the gross margin of Pega Cloud, which I think is an important operational metric. So those ones that I just mentioned are the major ones that I look at.
Okay. So, and then from an ACV standpoint, you had a really good acceleration, as I recall, in the on the most recent quarter. So is that just part of the cloud transition?
In terms of the ACV between Pega Cloud and Client Cloud, or just the total ACV?
I guess I'm drawing a blank on the number there, but it accelerated sequentially. So I don't remember if it was the Pega Cloud incidentally.
Let me tell you what happened. So I think this might be where you're going, Dan, but so the net add in ACV in a quarter is the productivity from selling. That's a simple way to think about it, right? You spend time selling and the net add in ACV is the net commitments that clients commit to us. In Q2, that increased by 50 million or so. It was a pretty big number, right? And in Q1, it increased by 20 million or so, rough numbers. So there was a pretty big sequential. When you go back to Q2 of last year, the increase was about like 25 million, maybe 27 million compared to almost 50 million this year. So you can see that there was a fairly big jump in both the Q2 over Q1 and the Q2 over last year, Q2. So that kind of helps like in a sequential and in a seasonality comparing. That's why that's such an important measure for us. Cause at the end of the day, if that's growing at an accelerated pace, it kind of fixes everything else, right? Like, because the revenue, the cash flow, the billings, everything's going to follow that.
Just maybe this is almost too personal, but I do struggle with like which one is more important here. Like I want to focus on the Pega Cloud ACV, but you actually give both ACVs, which I appreciate, you know, as like an analyst who's got to write some reports and do some analysis. But which one is more important from Pegasystems' point of view?
Well, it's an excellent question, and I'll give you my opinion why people might value one versus the other. I think it's all valuable. I don't think we should spend a lot of time getting caught up in one or the other, but I do know that some investors do, not all, but some investors do. Here's what I think is the misconception, and it's good for us to talk about it so people can continue to hear me explain this. Pega Cloud and Client Cloud are the exact same solution. The actual capabilities, the features, the value, the way it's configured, everything, same. There's not a difference at all. The only difference is that Pega Cloud is a fully managed offering, and Client Cloud is one that the client manages it on in their control plane, in their virtual private cloud. I think some investors don't understand that and think, oh, Client Cloud must be the old stuff on old releases and old versions, so everything's moving to Pega Cloud. Well, that's clearly not the case if we're selling just as much Client Cloud as Pega Cloud, like we did in Q2. So that's one misconception. The other misconception is that, and that one I think is a very reasonable misunderstanding because lots of people have moved to SaaS and they've almost deprecated old on-premise stuff and said, we're not going to support it anymore. You have to move, which is one of your questions a second ago. But that's not what we're doing. And I think that it's an easy misunderstanding for an investor to get confused on that. But here's the part that I think is an incorrect view that some investors have, which is SaaS is somehow worth more than subscription that is managed on a virtual private cloud. The profit margins of our client cloud are actually higher right now than our Pega Cloud. And the percentage margin will always be higher because you don't have the infrastructure layer. You don't have some of the. Now, we might make more over time from a gross margin dollars on an equivalent deal, but they're still going to be pretty close in terms of the profitability over time. So I think that there's this perception that SaaS is sexier, it's worth more, it's, you know, in the valuation kind of. So when they see Pega Cloud looking like growth may stabilize, some investors think that's a bad thing. I say, look at total ACV. Total ACV is the total commitments from clients. And I think, you know, and I use the extreme example. I used this with an investor last week, Dan. I said, imagine if Pega Cloud was growing 50%, but total ACV was only growing 12. Would you be happy about that? Or would you rather have Pega Cloud growing 30 and total ACV growing 30? Right? Like, which business would you want? And when you say that, investors go, well, of course I want the higher total. And I said, well, just remember that when you look at our results, because we want the higher total as well. So that's kind of how I tell the story.
Well, yeah, I think that puts it in a much clearer light. So, thank you. Maybe let me shift gears. I know we're starting to reach the end of time where we want to start polling the audience for questions, but let me get sort of squeeze one more in here before we do that. And that is just on the system integrator partner ecosystem. I know I hear a lot about this from every company now and how they're trying to do more and like get more partners on board. So maybe if we could talk about the ecosystem and your relationship with some of the system integrators.
Sure. So GSIs, as you mentioned, have always been, I shouldn't say always, but certainly in the last 10 years have been a big part of our resources to deploy our solutions, to implement, to configure, to manage, to do change management with our clients. They've done way more work with our clients than we have. And we have all the big name GSIs and you know that are certified with 1,000 or 1,000 plus, you know, Pega certified professionals in many of them. So that part, I think we have covered well. Here's what we didn't do as well. We didn't engage with those same GSIs in a partnering way around selling. And you know, shame on us for not doing that. But an example would be if we're trying to sell to bank ABC. And in the old world, we would go and try to sell it. We would tell our partners, we'll let you know when we win. And then when we won, we would go to the partner and say, okay, now why don't you go in and pitch your services? Sometimes that was literally what happened. So you can imagine if you're Accenture, right? You can imagine how frustrating that would be to say, like, can't you like you know, give us like we're, you know, we're partners with you. Like you won the deal. Give us a little bit of a chance to talk to the client, to work on our proposal. Like we're getting told to come in like after the fact. We were very defensive at Pega around letting anyone else around our client relationship. The you know, having a little bit of humility and stepping back, the Accentures of the world have better relationships with most of our clients, right? Because they're doing projects across lots of solutions. They're in with the executive team. They understand the roadmaps. It's almost illogical to not ask them to engage in a selling capacity opportunistically around Pega. They benefit, we benefit, the client benefits. So that's really that evolution of just using them as an implementation partner to really leveraging them as a lead, as a pipeline, even in a selling capacity, so that we're selling together in a coordinated way and that they're advocating for us as we advocate for them. And that's a good outcome for everybody.
A couple of follow-ups on that one. Is that are the economics for Pegasystems comparable between like a direct driven sale versus a, you know, like a channel driven sale? Like, you know, over the life of a client or however you want to answer that.
So if you think about bringing a GSI in, I'll separate a GSI from an ISV. So a global system integrator, they're not in the business of actually selling software. That's not what they want to do. So the amount of compensation or consideration that you might give them simply is helping to offset the marketing and selling costs to sell their solution, and also maybe some reduced or discounted professional services that they may do for the client in the initial year, just to kind of, you know, as part of winning the work. So that consideration is relatively insignificant in terms of the grand scheme of things. It's a one-time thing and doesn't really impact the economics, because on a partner-driven deal, we should have less selling costs and we should be able to send some of that selling cost to the partner as a consideration. So that's kind of the way. In an ISV model, it is very different. The ISV model, we're not selling. The ISV is selling. Where they're really buying an underlying capability platform from us, and there's a revenue share kind of agreement, right? Like, you know, however you want to, you know, could be at the user level, could be actually at the revenue level, but there's a sharing of that, because we don't absorb the sales costs and they will do first line support. They're building the configuration or the solution on top of our platform. So in that model, the economics are less revenue, but much higher margin, because we really don't have the selling activity. In the first one with GSIs that I mentioned, the economics look largely the same.
Okay, got it. Excuse me, that's helpful. So I'm gonna take some questions here as some have come into me here. So, and some of them are, I'll try and filter through them a little bit, and some of them are pretty interesting to me also. And so I kind of had similar questions, so I'm gonna cheat and ask those. So one is, in terms of hybrid work, we hear about this from everyone. I guess it's, you know, just a quick one for you. Like, what is Pegasystems doing with, you know, with your workforce and going forward and, you know, as the pandemic sort of evolves?
So we are, it's certainly, you know, I spend more time than I would like to thinking about this and talking to my peers and employees and customers. I think we're starting to see that the behavior of how we manage, of how we operate, of how we work is permanently, maybe too dramatic a word to use, but I would say not likely to change in the near future in terms of people want flexibility. We are still going to have offices. We're still going to go to offices. It's just not going to be the way that we did it before. We're going to have much more collaboration, mentoring, team meetings focused in offices, and individual work will be more, and even meetings, et cetera, will be more kind of remote to the extent that employees want to do that. Some of our employees will want to go into the office all the time, but we'll be in a little bit more of a flexible world where we expect the person that went in the office 5 days a week will probably go in the office 3 days a week and probably work remote too. In terms of travel, we will have less travel, but we will still have travel. We will probably have less physical events, but we will still have physical events. So I think you'll see a hybrid kind of model on our distribution and our interaction with clients, where will we still do a physical annual event? Absolutely. Will we do more virtual simulated events? And, you know, for more? Yes, we will do. So I think what we'll do is balance that digital and physical selling, where I think there, you know, our anticipation is about where 90% of the customer touches would have been physical in the old model. It's probably more like 50-50 now.
Interesting. That is generally consistent with what I hear from a lot of companies. So that's good news, I guess. And then as a follow-up just to something you said earlier and just the way you're talking about, more remote work. Just a question that ties in nicely with that is because you're not in Silicon Valley, does it make it harder or easier to find talent? Because everyone is talking about a talent war, mainly for sales and R&D. So how does that impact Pegasystems, and does like remote work make that, a challenge that's pretty easier to overcome?
So it is a very difficult talent attraction, retention, and cultivation environment, and one that I've probably not seen in my career, in terms of, the best employees want to work for the best companies, and the only way that you're going to keep those employees is if you create an environment that suits their individual needs. Some people want the flexibility to work remotely, so you have to give that. Some people don't want the flexibility. They actually want to go into an office, but they want to be mentored. They want to be part of something bigger. So you got to make sure you have that. I've heard some companies say, we're just going to go full remote. Well, that might work, but you're going to lose a certain population that actually doesn't want to go full remote. The other thing you have to do is you got to make sure you're getting the mentoring and the growth opportunities for those employees as you move to this new model. So for us, what we've thought about is we think kind of threading the needle on flexibility of work, flexibility of location when desired by that individual employee. But the balance of the mentoring and the interaction still will happen in a physical way so that we can kind of create a model where we can try to satisfy lots of different constituents in that discussion.
That's interesting because I do have a few companies that are sort of outside of Silicon Valley, and I was just especially now it seems like the dynamics are perhaps changing a little bit. So appreciate
I
your
think it
take.
also depends, Dan. I have talked to a few of my peers and one company in particular where they used to be a New York City-based company and they've since left New York City. They're exited their offices and they went remote. Their executive team and a lot of the people that were in the New York area went remote and they've all scattered to different places. That, however, it was a company that is not a very fast-growing company. And so they're not hiring a lot of new people, and they're probably a little bit more of a stable kind of play. So that worked for their employee base. There will be other companies that leaving a major metropolitan area might be a death blow to you in terms of attracting people. So I really do think every company needs to evaluate their own situation, their growth rate, the types of talent that they're getting, and where the market for those talent is. Is it in the major cities or is the flexibility of letting people work in Omaha or New England or California or Texas or Florida or wherever they want to go, is that a differentiation to hiring? And I do think it's company by company. I don't think there's a one size fits all.
Okay, great. I've got a few here that I'm going to combine into one because I think they're all kind of related. And so I'm sorry if I butcher this a little bit, but bear with me. So you said 98 to 99% retention, which I assume is client retention. Then you alluded to like a sort of a net dollar expansion, which is a metric a lot of companies use. So one is that a number that you give, and will you start giving it? And then sort of a related part of this is how much of your revenue comes from existing clients, which I don't know if they're getting at cross-selling opportunities or if they're just sort of wondering like, the installed base and how attractive of an asset that really is for you.
So we get in a pre-COVID year, so before COVID, we would typically get about two-thirds to 75% of our new business, sorry, our growth business that came from existing logos. During COVID, that number went above 80% because to the positive and the negative, it's easier to sell to existing logos and harder to sell to new logos in a virtual world. So that benefits us in some ways, it's more challenging in others. Where do I think that will land? I think it needs to kind of gravitate back down closer to the two-thirds to 75%, because we do need to be getting enough new logos. Although there's plenty of room to sell to our existing logos, we do want to have new logos each year, and we do want to generate business from those new logos. So I think that that's kind of how I would frame the new versus existing. Now, we mentioned gross retention, which is, you know, in the high 90s, and as commonly called net retention, you know, which is the growth, you know, the renewal plus the upsell. That has typically been in the 113 to 115% range for us the last few years. It has accelerated as our overall ACV has grown. So when our ACV was only growing 15% a year, we were doing more like 10%. Now we're growing ACV at 20%. We're probably doing 13 to 15% kind of net expansion. So that has trended up. So what that means is, as we grow more, more of the growth is actually coming from existing clients.
All right. So that is really interesting. And thanks. And so here's, maybe we should have addressed this one up front more, but someone's wondering about, like, who are your competitors? So I guess I would just, this is interesting to me. So I would add on, like, Microsoft, for example, bought, you know, like a whatever, you know, an a robotic, you know, an RPA company. So just wondering how the competitive landscape maybe is evolving.
Well, so there's companies that we compete with that are the ones that you know about, right? All the I would say that has not changed a lot, right? Even since I started, right? Like, this isn't just in the last year. Like, in the last 5-6 years, the brands that we go up against are, you know, it's kind of scary, but they're pretty much the same brands. There's not like a new entrant or two that are at scale. Where it's different is in the vertical and in some of the use cases. There are more competitors at a specific use case, which shouldn't surprise you, because as those use cases scale up, you would see focused people around things like, you know, a sales automation solution or a know your customer solution or a robotics solution or decisioning, like people or you know, customer data, you know, like, you know, certain platforms and products. So what I would say is the big enterprise companies that we compete with, largely unchanged. When we get into a very narrow scope competitive environment where we're selling one very fixed solution, the competitors there are more the lower end specialty competitors. So you, like, if you were going to sell a know your customer to solution to a mid-sized bank, you wouldn't see Salesforce there. You wouldn't see Microsoft there. You wouldn't see ServiceNow there. You wouldn't see. But when you're selling enterprise digital transformation, those are the ones you see. You don't see the smaller kind of ankle biters, smaller companies at one specialty solution. So I think where you go to the specialty solution, it's been a very dynamically changing environment there. Some companies do well, some get bought, some don't do so well. The problem that they all have is they can't scale. The reason why we win in those is not necessarily feature function differentiality. It's more their ability to scale up, right? It's that they can do that one use case, but if someone says, oh, I'd like to expand the use case to something different, they really fall down there. So the reason why we lose at the enterprise level is a little bit more because of the brand, right? Like, our brand isn't at the same level of brand of some of the other companies that I mentioned. And there is some truth to the, you know, you don't get fired for buying Salesforce kind of thing. You don't get fired for buying Microsoft like it used to be IBM. You know, at some point that, you know, that becomes easier to deal with. And we're starting to now get to a scale and a brand recognition that our brand is, you know, not well known, but certainly known much better than it was 5 years ago.
Yeah, right. And I think it's important, as I sort of alluded to early in the call, like, Pegasystems has been around for a long time. So certainly it shows up more. I see you've done some brand marketing, you know, like on the golfing circuit, for example. Yep. So yeah, nice job on the brand. And I agree, it's definitely more recognizable now. And I suspect that that is sort of a boulder rolling down a hill, right? Once you get some momentum, it's, you know,
right,
it's going to continue.
Yeah.
So I guess on that front, since I've already gone there, maybe I'll just ask the question myself. Like, what are we going to see more efforts in that regard? Are you doing more? Are we going to see billboards? And I haven't been in an airport in a while, but are we going to see like, some light up signs in airports and those kind of things?
So, interestingly enough, we did do some of that pre-COVID. We had an advertisement in Paddington Station in England. I mean, we had so we will continue to focus on very selective opportunities to get the brand out there. It will be in very select markets where our clients are. It'll be in very select events where we think our clients pay attention. It won't be just it won't be brand marketing across everything. It'll be more where we think clients are. Next week we are one of the few sponsors for the Ryder Cup. It's in Wisconsin, and so we will be hosting a number of clients there and building relationships. That's a perfect example of we feel like that's a match with our buying base. If it was Formula One racing is where our clients went, we would probably sponsor there. If it was soccer, we would go there. We've just found that recreational activities like golf as one seems to be a good draw and a good brand. And by the way, we love the return we got with Mel and Mark, in terms of the LPGA and the PGA. And that's been like, I mean, with the amount of earned media that we got from that is, 50 times the investment that we made with each one of them. And we love it.
Yeah, right. Obviously, great golfers, but I guess you really wouldn't expect them to be winning together together like that. So,
Well,
great job.
and also Mel Reed became really the face for pride within golf, right? And so just that and that really drew Pega into a whole different view of brand, which was awesome.
Yeah, for sure. So I have two more questions here. One of them is mine, since you were talking about like some of the more recognized companies. I assume that you're still showing up like in usage, like at a customer that is using like whoever, Salesforce, who you mentioned. Like how often is this happening? Like how often is Pegasystems being used? Maybe not side by side for the same use case, but like, whatever. One of your competitors in there you being used for one thing, and Pegasystems is in there being used for something else.
I'm not sure that I'm aware, excuse me, of a client that has Pega and doesn't have Salesforce.
That is really interesting. So I
I
can't
mean, they're
actually.
everywhere, right? I mean,
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
like, I mean, even Microsoft. I mean, it may not be Dynamics, but Microsoft is in every client. Salesforce is in most clients. And the reality is these clients are big. They've got divisions, they've got buyers, they've got multiple use cases. They tend to spread across multiple vendors.
It makes sense too, but quite honestly, I guess I'm a little surprised. A little surprised. I mean, just hearing you say that, so that's a new piece of information for me. So I guess we're running out of time. I'm going to ask this one last question that someone else is wondering about, and that's just your M&A strategy. You're not like a big M&A shop, but they
So
happen.
we have to be careful with M&A because one of the differentiations we have is that the platform is unified. The fact that we can do real time, we can integrate anywhere, and that as we progress work, it's not disparate clouds and different workflows that cause like lack of speed, lack of transparency, aggregation of data, automation. So because that's really important to us, when we do acquisitions, we tend to think about how they'll fit in with the platform, how they'll fit in with our unified solution. That's why we typically don't go out and just buy something that is more of an orthogonal product or something that is sold separate from the actual platform. Now, that might change over time. As companies get bigger, they do change that strategy I've seen. But right now, we feel like there's so much opportunity to sell our core platform into the core use cases without getting distracted by buying another company that has a completely separate sales team. So what we look for is technology tuck-ins, so to speak, that we expand the footprint. Robotics was a great example of that, right? We now sell robotics as a feature within the actual workflow, within the platform, and get an uplift for that, as opposed to selling RPA on a standalone basis to different clients. So that's our strategy right now. I mean, that could change in a few years, but right now that is our strategy.
I mean, my experience is that A, that makes sense, but B, you know, I don't know. The investors I talk to generally don't seem to love, you know, larger deals anyway. So,
well, there's a lot of risk in them, right? And that's, and especially when you have one sales force that's focused on 500, 1,000 orgs, you got to be really crisp. You don't want distractions of selling other tiny solutions and confusing the client on, you know, what you do. So that's kind of something we are sensitive to.
Yeah, right. Great. So I guess overall, thank you for some really insightful answers. I learned some stuff myself, which is great. I don't know if there's any closing comments you want to have for those of us who are listening here.
I would thank everyone for the time and the continued conversation. We're working hard for you, working hard to drive value in the business, and look forward to catching up with you again, Dan.